Welcome to the Rosenberg Roundup. I'm Dylan Smith.
And I'm Jacob Rosenberg.
Hey, Jacob, have you loaded up on meme stocks this week, or did you miss the bus like me?
As a former cat owner myself, Dylan, I can tell you this, and that's that I've already learned the hard way that it's best to avoid a roaring kitty. I'm going to be watching this one from the sidelines, I think.
Yeah, if my upbringing in South Africa taught me anything, it's that any roaring cat is worth avoiding. One guy posts a cryptic tweet and three stocks rise over 100%. It does sometimes make us wonder why we bother with the fundamentals.
I hear you, but bother with them, we must. We have some interesting fundamentals to cover this week, though, I think.
We do. We'll run through a trifecta of soft US data and why it's spurring a broad rally even outside of those meme stocks. And just to paint the picture there, we've got all the US equity benchmarks hitting new highs this week. And at time of recording, S&P 500 up over 1.5%, 10-year treasuries total return up almost as much. We have the oil price up a full 2% after falling early in the week. Gold is up 1%, and the US dollar really the only loser in that complex, down 1%, obviously. So we're going to get into all of that. And then our spotlight today shines on emerging markets, and good timing on that too, as you will see.
Sounds like a plan to me. Let's get going with the week in review. Let's kick things off with those soft US data points that came out after we spoke last week.
Yeah, it all started last Friday after we released the podcast with the UMISH Consumer Sentiment Index. That's probably the most followed gauge of consumer sentiment in the US. And that showed a massive drop in consumer confidence. The worst monthly drop actually since 2021. And we all know what was happening around that time. And more importantly, we saw a big pullback in planned spending. So clearly some consumers, they're feeling worried about their ability to make discretionary spending plans. And that rise in pessimism definitely leaking through into the hard data too, because we saw no growth at all in retail sales in April versus markets expecting almost 0.5% month on month of growth. And we saw a decline in volume terms once you strip out inflation. More importantly even is that the elements of the sales report that flowed directly into GDP fell pretty hard. So not a great start for the quarter there in terms of growth. But the big news and the biggest data point we've had this week was inflation, which also came a little soft alongside the retail sales report. So we had a 0.3% month on month and 3.4% year on year, which is just a touch under what was expected. And markets reacted with a lot of relief to that number. So that triggered the rally. The underlying story behind that inflation number really just remained the same as we've been seeing for the last few months, which is that goods prices and interest-sensitive categories are actively deflating, so prices there are coming down a bit. And almost all of the inflation is coming from just three sources, which is healthcare, insurance, especially vehicle insurance, and rents, which, as we've discussed before, will start to decline rapidly over the summer when the sample starts to incorporate the current low real-time rental for people switching apartments now. So those were the big three. We also had more peripheral data pointing in the same direction. We had the New York Empire State Manufacturing Index and the Philly Fed Business Index, regional measures of activity, both showing big drops in May. And that's the first data we've actually seen for May, so not a great start there either. We had industrial production contracting. We had very soft housing market data as well from starts and from the Home Builders Association index on housing market activity.
I want to get into those inflation numbers with you, Dylan, but first I want to ask you, what do you think is changing for the U.S. consumer? I thought that it was the quote-unquote Energizer Bunny that was keeping global growth going.
Well, in simple terms, I think the U.S. consumer is finally running out of ways to finance spending growth, right? We've been discussing for a while all these different one-off factors that have helped consumption stay high in the U.S. even as it's flattened out in the rest of the world. So savings rates have pretty much bottomed out there. There's no more impulse. People can't really save much less than they're already saving at just around 3% versus the sort of 6%+ average you usually see. We're seeing credit card delinquencies up to almost a 14-year high of 10.5% of outstanding balances. I remember that 14 years ago, it was still settling down from the big delinquency spurge after the global financial crisis. U.S. government spending has been helping consumption as well, and it's still very high, but it's also not growing much from that very high level in 2023. So there's no impulse to feed through to spending growth, rather than that's just flat. And we could probably say the upper segment of the market is still benefiting from a wealth effect from high equity prices and high home prices, but that impulse is starting to fade. It was a very big factor behind Q1 GDP, but that can't go on forever either. Meanwhile, the burden of high interest rates is starting to bite, and it's really these interest-sensitive categories that we're really seeing demand collapse. And, you know, that's things like furnitures, automobiles, things people buy on credit, and that's feeding through into deflation, these cyclical components. So we've had our measure of cyclical inflation falling by half a percentage point year on year. So relationship here between consumer spending and falling demand and deflation, but still probably a little more inflation than the Fed would like to see overall. And one interesting point to make on inflation is that we also had producer prices data this week, and that came in pretty warm. It was 0.5% month on month. A lot of that is because businesses are seeing a higher cost base on commodities prices being quite high at the moment. And typically you'd think that that would feed through into a high number on consumer prices because they have a long run correlation of almost 93%. But that's on average. And what you need for that correlation to be there is for margins, so the markups that people who are ultimately selling to consumers are making over production prices, you need those margins to be stable. But one thing we're seeing consistently in the surveys and also in things like earnings reports from places like McDonald's, places like Home Depot, is that we just aren't seeing pricing power for corporates at the moment. They're squeezing their own margins down, and that's meaning that producer price inflation is not feeding through to final consumer price inflation. And it's also evidence of generally, you know, flagging demand. And so that's an important thing to think about.
So between the U.S. consumer slipping, you got corporate pricing power diminishing to help bring inflation down. I wouldn't say that really sounds like an equity buy. But how would you explain the market response?
It's all about interest rates. A downward move in inflation, even a small one, and a more disinflationary outlook is what the Fed is looking for in order to start cutting. And markets know that, so the implied market pricing is back to 2 cuts for this year from 1.5 before the CPI release. And those cuts are expected to happen a month or so earlier than initially. So we've got more easing in the environment around interest rates. And lower interest rates are good for equities because they mean lower discount rates on future earnings, and that should improve current stock prices, and also, you know, lower costs on investment and so on, as well as lower returns on alternative assets to equities like fixed income. So in the tug of war between a kind of cloudier consumer outlook, a weakening growth outlook, and lower interest rates, this week at least, lower interest rates were the big winner. Now, looking across the different markets, Iranian bonds is much easier to understand. Lower yields mean higher bond prices. But it's worth noting that the Iranian bonds was global, despite this all being U.S. data, because there's a perception out there, and even if it's a wrong perception, that other central banks like the ECB and the Bank of England and the Bank of Canada will hold off on easing until the Fed looks ready to pull the trigger. So the Fed moving a bit earlier on the margin says that the whole global rate complex can start to come down a little easier, and that's why markets are so excited.
I think that's actually a pretty good segue into our spotlight, Dylan, because you and our colleague Paul Kim recently took a look at what all of that means for emerging markets, I think.
Well, credit where it's due, this was more Paul's work than mine, although I was very interested given my background in emerging markets. And the question we were trying to think about this week was, how do emerging market assets, and particularly emerging market equities, how do they trade the cycle? Will it be the same as previous cycles, or will it be different? Because we think there's a big change going on in terms of the linkage between how people invest in emerging markets and what prices do there and the kind of global cycle. So back in the day, we would see all EMs basically trade as a big block, right? Rising when the U.S. eased rates and selling off really hard when the U.S. raised rates, or when global risk sentiment turned sour and we had risk-off episodes that would really hurt just all EMs as a block. But they're no longer a single block like that anymore. These economies have advanced. The management of the economy is coming much, much better. They have independent monetary policy by and large. So what we're seeing is that local factors actually matter much more. And broadly, it's hard to distinguish between EMs as a whole. You have to look at their country-specific characteristics. So countries with strong fiscal management, good reserve stocks, well-managed current account balances, they've begun to insulate themselves a bit from the whims of U.S. monetary policy and global monetary policy. And there's another issue that we wanted to look at that doesn't really have much precedent, which is that this week's move aside, the U.S. is going to cut later and cut less than other central banks in the world. So the question there then becomes, is it U.S. rates that emerging markets assets typically respond to, or is it some measure of global rates, excluding the U.S., that also matter? Right. And if those go out of sync, what does that mean?
And how did you guys tackle that?
Well, those are two complicated questions, but not impossible, at least not for Paul. So without getting too technical, Paul built a model that can basically handle both of those questions and look at how emerging market stocks respond to global interest rates, how they respond to U.S. interest rates, depending on their local features. And there were points where he was tearing his hair out because it's a difficult task, but the final outcome was very impressive indeed.
And what would you say were your biggest findings then?
Well, we were able to look at excess equity returns in emerging markets in connection with, as I said, U.S. and global rates under various different scenarios. So we looked at what happens if current pricing plays out, where you get this big divergence opening up between the U.S. and Europe. What happens if the U.S. doesn't cut at all, say, if inflation stays quite sticky, but Europe does? Or what happens if, you know, there's such a deep slowdown in the U.S. or a recession, as we expect, that leads the U.S. to cut quite sharply? And we kind of looked across those scenarios at which EMs were the big winners, and the consistent ones that performed fairly well were actually the more rate-sensitive ones, sensitive to global rates, sensitive to U.S. rates as well. That includes countries like Brazil, Mexico, emerging Asia, which just as long as there's cutting happening, they benefit. And then there's some that perform under more specific scenarios. So something like Hungary and Eastern Europe more broadly will outperform if the U.S. doesn't cut, but Europe does. That's, you know, fairly obvious given their trade links and their capital flow links to Europe. And our two favorites among emerging markets, Mexico and India, are set to benefit, you know, fairly well. They're not a top performer under every scenario, but they still perform well. And that's in addition to the strong structural forces already pushing up equities in those countries. One last point to make. China is among the bottom of all performers in terms of the sensitivity to U.S. rates and global rates. Easier policy in the West does not seem to be a source of support for China. So for all the problems happening in China there, lower U.S. rates do not point to a huge boost for Chinese stocks. Part of that is that, of course, it implies a weaker dollar and a stronger Chinese currency, which hurts the trade balance.
Well, that wraps up yet another episode of the Rosenberg Roundup. As always, thank you for listening. Make sure to leave us a review, and we will be sure to see you back here in 1 week's time.
I'm Dylan Smith. You're Jacob Rosenberg. And that was the Rosenberg Roundup.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Rosenberg Roundup. For more information on our work and to take advantage of a free 30-day trial of our research, please visit rosenbergresearch.com. Make sure to tune in to our next episode for more insightful analysis on the macro and market landscape. Rosenberg Roundup is provided for general information and entertainment purposes only and does not constitute legal or professional advice, nor is it an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to purchase any security or derivative. Any views expressed by the participants of Rosenberg Roundup are solely their own and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, beliefs, or policies of Rosenberg Research.